from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
And good evening, a very good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening, wherever you happen to be listening from. We are Rated LGBT Radio, and it is wonderful to be with you once again. We have the latest hot news for the LGBT community and ecosphere coming up, some of the top stories, and we have some of the most important news-making guests of the day, not to mention our crackerjack and expert panel of journalists who are here to ask some of the tough questions. So tonight is a unique night, as all of the nights we've tried to provide you, but it's certainly up there with one of the most special. We have waiting on deck to talk to us the one, the only, Sarah McBride, the history maker who addressed the Democratic National Convention, the first transgender individual to do so, and she did it with grace and poise and wonderment, and is a true leader in the LGBT rights movement. And she's coming out with a new book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. We are going to talk to her about that. But first, we're going to go to Brody Levesque and the news. Brody, welcome aboard.
Good evening. Headlines for Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. Ongoing protests by survivors in the aftermath of last week's mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, have been led in part by openly out members of the LGBTQI community, including the student president of the Douglas High School GSA, Emma Gonzalez, and then joining the students in Tallahassee at Florida's Capitol to speak with lawmakers and Florida Governor Rick Scott on Tuesday and Wednesday, was Brandon Wolf, a young gay man and activist who had survived the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando nearly 2 years ago. In a related story, organizers of the March for Our Lives rally against mass shootings planned for next month in Washington are expecting up to 500,000 attendees, according to an event permit application. The application filed this week with the U.S. National Park Service indicates the march will be on March 24th, although a start-off location in the nation's capital has yet to be determined. The event will include student speakers, musical performers, guest speakers, and video tributes, according to the application, with 14 jumbotrons and 2,000 chairs. In Washington, the date for Defense Secretary James Mattis to make recommendations to President Trump was February 21st, 2018, Wednesday, for the trans service policy that was supposed to be implemented after the courts had ordered the ban that was put into effect after his tweets last summer had been put on stay. However, according to Dominic Holden, a political reporter for BuzzFeed News, the deadline passed, and now federal agencies in the White House have been pointing fingers at each other, revealing there was no clear message about what was happening or who would make an announcement. On Wednesday, the Pentagon told BuzzFeed News that it wouldn't make an announcement, but the White House could say something. The White House referred questions to the National Security Council, which had no information, and instead referred the media outlet back to the Pentagon. Major David Eastburn, a Pentagon spokesperson, told BuzzFeed in an email Thursday, "No notification has been made yet. Secretary Mattis will make his recommendations to the White House soon, and the president will decide how we will move forward." 1 week after mass shooter Nicholas Cruz murdered 17 people inside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel, in a Thursday afternoon press briefing, revealed a stunning series of failures by the Sheriff's Department. The school resource officer stationed at the campus, Broward County Deputy Sheriff Scott Peterson, had heard the gunfire, rushed to the building, but never went inside, instead waiting outside for another 4 agonizing minutes as Cruz continued the slaughter. Sheriff Israel told reporters Peterson had resigned after investigators reviewed surveillance footage of the Parkland shooting. I am devastated, Israel said. Sick to my stomach. He never went in. Finally, Missouri Republican Governor Eric Greitens was indicted on a felony invasion of privacy charge and then arrested, according to a St. Louis prosecutor in an emailed statement late Thursday afternoon. The indictment stems from a probe into an extramarital affair and an allegation of blackmail involving the governor. Tonight, it is my distinct privilege, honor, and pleasure to introduce to our listening audience someone that I first met on the campus of the American University in Washington in 2012 after an article had appeared in that university's student-run newspaper about their outgoing student body president, who had done an amazing thing. I spent an hour and a half with one of the most incredible young women I think I have ever had the pleasure of meeting and then getting to know. You know, oftentimes you meet people as a journalist, and it's a mix. It's everyday folks. It's famous people. But every once in a rare while, you meet that one person that resonates with you, and you say to yourself, this one's going to make a difference. There's something about this person. I can just feel it. In the ongoing years, we've crossed paths several times. She was an intern in the Obama White House. She worked for the Center for American Progress, a center-left think tank in Washington that does a tremendous amount of good work for a lot of communities and progressive issues. As a matter of fact, there that she met her husband, who sadly I never had an opportunity to get to know, and I'll let Sarah talk about that. Unfortunately, tragically, the marriage ended rather abruptly because her husband had cancer, and he sadly passed away. But that has not really deterred her much. She's one of these people that just puts her foot forward, and as the title of her book indicates, tomorrow will be different. And every time I encounter her, it's like I just get this great shock of pleasure, because I just feel so good about where she's going and what she's doing. And like me, she's also a very, very big, huge fan of the West Wing. And I'll have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, especially after her appearance at the 2016 Democratic Convention, this is a person that I can see calling Madam President. So without further ado, Sarah, I am so glad to say hi to you on the air in front of all these people, and welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I don't know. I feel like we should just end the show right now, because nothing I could say could top that incredibly kind introduction. Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
How we like to start the show. Yeah, we like to completely intimidate our guests with flowers and roses so that they are left almost speechless, which, come to think of it, is not necessarily the best strategy on our part. But anyway, that's what we do. So welcome aboard.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sarah, you're not even 30 years old yet. You've written a book. You've spoken in front of a major party's convention. You're tracking all over the place. You're the spokesperson, National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. It just, to me, it's like, you know, ever since we met that fine spring morning at American University, I'm like, what's next? So let's talk about the book. You're not even 30. And then I'm going to kind of let Rob and Don have their, have their way with you, as it were. But the book, why?
Well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, you mentioned I'm only 27 years old, and I sort of understand the almost absurdity in a 27-year-old writing a memoir. But To your introduction, I do feel like over the last 6 years since coming out as transgender, I've had a pretty incredible journey, a journey of significant highs, whether it's the love and support of the campus community at American University when I came out, or the total affirmation and joy in the arena at the Democratic National Convention, to significant lows, whether it's finding out that my boyfriend at the time, Andy, was diagnosed with cancer, to losing him to cancer just 4 days after we were fortunate enough to marry in 2014. And so I feel like I have a story to share. And I believe that stories have the power to make change. to move equality forward, and in some cases to make history. And at this pivotal moment in the fight for trans equality, I believe now more than ever we need stories. We need to open hearts and change minds so we can continue to move forward no matter who is president. And I decided to write this book because I want to share that story with so many other people. I want to help demonstrate that transgender people are first and foremost people who love and laugh, hope and dream, fear and cry just like everyone else. And so I wrote this book. It was difficult to write, but I wrote it because I believe that our voices matter and our stories have the impact to affect change.
Sarah, the book is wonderful. It is relevant. It is poignant. You go through a lot of the experience that I think is common for a lot of people who are transgender, but then you pull in your very unique story, tragedy, relationships, everything. I can't wait for people to just eat this up as you promote it out across the country. I'm going to bring on in a second our other panelist, Dawn Ennis, and she and I both are starting right at the preface. The preface was written, or the foreword was written by Joe Biden. And so we both have some initial Biden questions for you. But mine comes from Joe Biden is a particularly poignant figure for me because not only, you know, as we're all aware, he was probably the first public official who kind of just laid the gauntlet out and said yes on equality, you know, before Obama did, before Hillary did, anybody. Mm-hmm. But when he did, I'm a gay dad raising two boys on my own, essentially. And in the interview, everybody called out kind of his reference to Will and Grace. But he really talked about something else there. He really talked about relating to gay dads and being one of us because of his own personal experience. And I apologize for this long-winded question because there is a question here. My experience as a gay dad has elements of transgenderism in it, in the sense that so much of the role of a gay dad is challenging gender norms in terms of what a parent is and who a parent is, et cetera. And so that persona of Joe Biden for me makes him a hero because he, even though he was not gay, he did that. He was that for his boys and who he was mm-hmm. growing up. So here's my question to you. Did you ever get the sense from him of kind of this extra empathetic knowledge of the transgender experience?
I think that's a great question. And I think you touch on a lot of things that I think people in Delaware, where I'm from, have been able to see over the last 40 years of his public service, which is that at the heart of Joe Biden is a truly compassionate person who has been through so much tragedy, but through that tragedy, as he talks about, he has seen the power in his own life of empathy and compassion, and he recognizes that even just a kind word here and there, a pat on the back, a call, can really make a difference for a person who's hurting. And I think he has tried to sort of live his life and his public life with those lessons that he learned from being a for a period of time, single father, from losing his wife, first wife, his young daughter, and then, of course, later, more recently, losing his son to cancer. I sort of enter into the Biden orbit and Biden family through my work relationship with his son, Beau, who I worked for when he was running for attorney general, and then again when he was running for re-election as attorney general. And Beau was an exceptionally humble human being, a caring human being. And I think in many ways, Joe Biden looks up to his son to this day. And Beau, when I came out, Beau was nothing but supportive, nothing but loving and attentive. And I think that his father saw that, and I think one point said to me, pulled me aside and said, Bo is so proud of you, Jill is so proud of you, and I'm so proud of you, after I saw him at the vice president's house after coming out. And, you know, I don't know whether there's unique experiences there in being able to empathize with the community more than others. Perhaps there is.
Sarah, did we lose you?
What I do know.
Oh.
No, I'm there. I'm still there. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can.
Can you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah. Yes, we can.
So I was just going to say, whether there's unique experiences there that allows him to relate more to the community, perhaps. But what I do know is that whether it's LGBTQ people, women, people of color, immigrants, that Joe Biden understands the importance of empathy and compassion.
Dawn?
Sarah, it's Dawn Ennis. It's such...
Hey,
I
Dawn.
Say, Madam President. I liked what Brody said. I stick with that because it'll just have to take a little bit of time. staying with the topic that we're talking about right now, you came out in 2012. That's the same year that your friend Joe Biden said that transgender rights were the civil rights issue of our time, which he also wrote in your foreword, and he talked about how you were a Biden even then, back when you were working with Bo. I'd like to know, is there a connection between Biden's declaration of the transgender rights being a civil rights issue of our time in 2012 and your coming out? Did you inspire him to say that?
Well, I think Joe Biden is someone who understands and is able to sort of see as issues are coming to the forefront that he is supposed to be, that he should be at the forefront of equality, that he needs to understand and be ahead of issues. And I think that in many ways he has been that on marriage equality, he has been that on trans equality. Whether my coming out, whether my relationship with the Biden family had an impact on that statement, I can't say one way or the other, but what I can say is I know throughout my own life, I think it, throughout all of our lives as transgender people, we can see that when you know someone who is transgender, it does change the way you think about an issue. It changes how you prioritize an issue. It humanizes the issue that you're talking about. And people find passion when they are able to empathize with a community. And so we know when you know someone, your support for equality increases. So whether his relationship and the relationship between me and his family had an impact, I can't say, but I do know more broadly that relationships matter. Knowing someone matters. And as more people come out, we're going to see more hearts and minds change.
I think one of the things that's kind of important to note too, and we'll kind of shift away from that for a second. You know, I've had several conversations with your colleague and good friend, Bishop Gene Robinson. And one of the most important things that Bishop Gene used to tell me was that the being out there as the role model, that was the tangibility to it, was the most important thing. And then he referenced you. You spent a lot of time on the road for the Human Rights Campaign and in other things that you're working on. You've met Jazz, for example, and some of the other younger trans kids. What do you tell them? I mean, what's the most important thing to you? Because, it's very difficult. You and I had that conversation that spring day many years ago. But how much has it changed from that conversation we had that day at American University to now in terms of how you view yourself as a role model? And what do you tell these kids, sir?
Well, I really appreciate you describing me as a role model, and I certainly try my best to make the community proud in the work and advocacy that I do. One of the joys of my job is that I get to travel around the country and meet young transgender people, sometimes 7, 8, 9 years old. Transgender youth like Lulu, who is an 8-year-old transgender girl. And when she met me, her first question was so filled with pride that it would not have made sense to my shame-filled 7-year-old self. She asked me quite simply, what's my favorite part about being transgender? And, at 26, having never heard that question before, it was a profound moment for me, knowing that there is a generation of transgender youth right now for whom they are living authentically and doing so with such incredible pride in themselves. And so whenever I meet transgender youth, I don't try to impart wisdom on them. I don't try to tell them, give them advice because, everyone is the best expert on what they need to be safe and to ensure their well-being. But what I do is I always ask them what's their favorite part about being transgender, because I want to make sure that everyone I'm coming in contact with isn't just thinking about their identity and the challenges that come with it, but rather thinking about their identity and the joys and the opportunities and the enlightenment that comes from it. If I can help make a young transgender person be even more proud of themselves and their identity, then I feel like, my job is done, and in many ways. And so I always ask transgenders that question. But I got to be honest, in my work, I feel like I find much more inspiration in them than they find in me. I think what has changed in the last 6 years since those first conversations we had, Brody, is that over the last 6 years, I have seen that change is and always will be possible. And I think in this sort of dark political moment, in this dark time in our nation's history, it's easy to lose sight of that. It's easy to think that our politics is so broken that we can no longer do big things. But, Dawn and I can both relate to this. 10, 15 years ago, the thought of living authentically and pursuing our dreams at the same time would have seemed so impossible that it would almost be incomprehensible. And today there are hundreds of thousands of transgender people, youth living across this country who even at 8, 9, 10 years old are both living their truth and dreaming big dreams. And in the last 10 years, in the last 15 years, as a community and as a movement, we have transformed impossibility into possibility, into reality. And that is politics, that is advocacy at its best, transforming impossibility and changing it into possibility. And if we can do it, if we've done it before, then we can do it again. And so for me, I feel like I find so much hope and so much inspiration and empowerment from meeting those young people. And if I can help them in any kind of way, if I can empower them in any kind of way, then I feel like it's an honest day's work.
There you go.
So much of your book was about your love story with Andy, and it was so poignant and heartfelt all the way through. And there were many times when I was reading it, it was interesting because I almost lost sight of that you were transgender, but that more that you were the spouse of a transgender person. What do you take from being in that unique position? Do you also find yourself advocating or speaking to the people who are the loved ones of transgender people, as well as being transgender? In my mind, it puts you in this incredibly unique perspective that you can provide for people.
I think that's an incredibly poignant observation. I do believe that I come to my work as an advocate, not just as someone who is transgender, but also as someone who's loved someone who's transgender. And I think so often transgender people in our sort of political discourse and just social awareness can sort of easily be isolated into a life of discrimination or violence or otherness. And one of the things we have to do is we have to contextualize transgender people in our full humanity. We have to remind people that transgender people have hopes and dreams, that we are parents and siblings and children and coworkers and teachers and we're neighbors. We need to remind people that we exist in society just like everyone else. And it's a almost absurdly simple point, but it's also a transformative point. And so I wanted to share that story, that love story, because whether you are someone who is transgender or someone who would love someone who's transgender, I can relate to that experience. And in many ways, it has informed my advocacy. And certainly, as I talk about in the book, my relationship with Andy fundamentally transformed the way I go about my work. It really underscored for me what Dr. King called the fierce urgency of now, that every single day matters when it comes to building a world where every person can live their life to the fullest, as I said at the convention in 2016. And so, I think your question is spot on. It's a unique perspective to come from, and it also has allowed me to really, I think, work with and connect with parents of trans youth and trans and the spouses or significant others of transgender people who are so important in our advocacy work.
Sarah, it's Dawn. And, you know, one of the friends we have on Facebook commented that she learned a lesson not to read your book in an office where there aren't any tissues. This is a book not just for LGBT or transgender people, but for anyone who's loved and lost. And even though we're mm-hmm. of different generations, you and I both lost the love of our lives to cancer, and especially after a point where we thought that cancer had been beaten. It's mm-hmm. been 3 years since Andy's passing, and I know that there's no getting over. You just learn to live with a hole in your heart. But how has this book helped you in terms of that effort on a personal level? I think that people see Sarah standing in front of the Democratic National Convention. They see her on mic and on the Internet, and they see you being such a wonderful activist. But this book opens up your heart in a way that you probably never have, except for that article that you brought me to tears in 2015 in which you told the story of you and Andy. I don't know if many people have really heard you open up like you are in this book.
Well, first off, you know, Dawn, my heart goes out to you, and I remember we both experienced loss around the exact same time, and you know, I always want to send you my love and tell you that you know, when I think of Andy, I also think oftentimes of your loss and the similarities and the differences in our experiences. And you know, I just want you to know my heart always goes out to you.
Well, right back at you.
It was difficult. Thank you. It was difficult writing this book. I'm going to be honest. There were a lot of points where I had to put the computer down and step away because the emotions were still, even 2-3 years later, just so raw. But in many ways, it was also an opportunity to experience some of the incredible high points of our relationship and to remember Andy in a way that extends beyond his cancer. I think in many ways when I talk about Andy in my advocacy, because I'm only able to talk about a little bit of our relationship and I don't have too much time or I can't share everything, it obviously ends up focusing on the end of our relationship and his eventual passing. But what I really appreciate about this book and what I've been and the experience of writing this book is that I was able to relive the experiences that bring a smile to my face and not a tear to my eye, as Joe Biden says. And that was truly a blessing in many ways, to be able to process those experiences, to be able to relive some of those experiences, sometimes bittersweet, but other times, you know, I'd find myself giggling or just grinning as wide as possible at something Andy had said or done, because he was truly one of the most exceptionally kind and smart and funny people that I have ever met in my life, if not the most in all of those ways. And I feel so lucky to have had Andy in my life, and I feel privileged to be able to continue to draw from the lessons of my relationship with Andy, not just the lessons that I gained from his passing, but also the lessons I gained from my conversations with him, from watching him do his incredibly transformative work. All of those experiences I carry with me, and I always every day, as I'm sure so many other people do with their loved ones, think to myself, what would Andy do?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
As a longtime trans ally and advocate, and it was because nearly 30 years ago, when I was having a real tough time with my wife, it was two members of the trans community that basically saved my life. And that's kind of what's always set me on the path of being an ally. One of the most interesting things I found along the way is that sometimes it's the little things. Let's talk about bathroom bills. Let's talk about the viral selfie that went around the globe. So you're in North Carolina. We have an onerous bill passed, and here's the caption. I'll read from your book. I posted the photo on Instagram and Facebook with the caption, "Here I am using a woman's restroom in North Carolina that I'm technically barred from being in. They say I'm a pervert. They say I'm a man dressed as a woman. They say I'm a threat to their children. They say I'm confused. They say I'm dangerous. And they say accepting me as the person I fought my life to be seen as reflects the downfall of a once great nation. I could go on and on and on, but let me throw a question in here, Sarah. We have now a scenario where within the LGBTQI community, the trans community in particular, is at the tip of the spear. And even though we have our ups and downs with administrations and so forth, we still have this issue. How the hell do we get people to understand that it is an element of humanity? It is not an element of biology. It's not the bloody DNA. It's not the, if you're born this way, that's what you are, nonsensical argument. Where do we go? Where do we get to the point where we don't have viral photographs like that one blowing up reporters like me and their phones at 5 in the morning? I mean, there's the question. Where do we go from here, Sarah?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think in many ways it begins with stories. It begins with sharing our full humanity as transgender people and reminding individuals that we have hopes and dreams just like they do. It's about reminding people that we have families and loved ones and friends. And I think when we do that, we allow people to find passion and compassion for transgender people. And when you have passion and when you have empathy for transgender people, it becomes much harder to support discrimination. But I also think one of the challenges we have as a community is that it's difficult for non-transgender people, for cisgender people, to understand what it feels like to be transgender. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is I try to invite non-transgender readers in to that experience in a way that allows them to begin to wrap their minds around that sensation, that experience, because I think so often the public gets caught up in their inability to relate. And with gay, lesbian, bisexual, and queer individuals, the straight population generally understands what it feels like to love and lust. But most people who aren't transgender certainly can't relate or understand the experience of having a gender identity that differs from your sex assigned at birth. And so I think one of the things we have to do is we have to share our stories. We have to articulate that in a way that allows cisgender audiences, cisgender readers, cisgender listeners, to be able to begin to wrap their mind around it so they can move past that question and begin to see the full humanity of transgender people. And I think we've done that. I think we already are doing that. And one of the things that has become clear to me is that even with Donald Trump and Mike Pence in the White House, transgender people have an alliance of allies standing by our side in record numbers in ways that we never had 5 or 10 years ago. And with that alliance of allies, we are able to defeat anti-transgender and anti-LGBTQ bills. We're able to push back when this administration tries to legalize discrimination in the workplace or in federal contracts or in the military. And when we do that, when we have that alliance of allies that can articulate that when you ban a transgender person from a restroom consistent with their gender identity, it doesn't just impact their access to a restroom. It makes it much more difficult for them to go to school or go to work or really to even leave their house for more than 2 to 3 hours. And that these bills, they're not about bathrooms. They're about legislating transgender people out of public life. And when we allow people to enter into our lives, and we allow people to gain empathy and compassion for us, and when we explain the impact of these bills, I think we win people over. And I think we saw that in North Carolina.
Sarah, one of the things you were just talking about or kind of relates to that is transgender visibility. And my question to you has to do with a very specific visibility, and that is the moment you stepped on stage at the Democratic National Convention. And this was, I mean, you walked into the history books. You stepped right into breaking, you know, a barrier. You became a landmark unto yourself. And in your book, you talk about it, and you talk about running into someone right afterwards who, an older transgender lady who is in tears because she didn't believe she would see this, quote unquote, in her lifetime. What was that moment like? And were you conscious as you stepped out that this was historic, or was it just the fact that there was this huge, humongous crowd standing in front of you?
Well, it was a surreal experience, and I think in many ways I understood that it was a first, but I didn't fully realize that it would have an impact for transgender people of really every age who are watching, whether in the arena or on television. You know, I had gotten sort of used to being in D.C., seeing the excitement and the passion among progressive leaders for trans equality over the previous year or two. But for so many people in the community, they had not seen that, right? They did not have access to the emails and calls and outreach from members of Congress who were saying, we want to do something on trans rights. What can we do? How can we help? And so that convention was really their first experience of seeing a mainstream political entity embrace our cause and celebrate our lives. And I didn't fully realize that until the hours after the convention, as I saw parents of transgender youth posting videos of their children watching the speech, or as I talked to transgender people both at the convention and who are watching at home, who articulated the point that you made, that older transgender woman made to me, which is that they never thought that they'd see something like that in their lifetime. And it wasn't about me. Most people had no idea who I was. It wasn't about what I said, but it was about the fact that in one of the most cautious industries that exists in politics, there was an arena full of people standing up, affirming our dignity, acknowledging and respecting our identities, and declaring with a singular voice that our cause was their cause. And, you know, that goes to the point that I made before, which is that even with Donald Trump in the White House, we have an alliance of allies that we've never had by our side before. And you know, for me personally, and I talked about this on CNN right after the interview, because there were a couple pictures that snapped of me with my parents crying on the convention floor. You know, the whole time I could see my family standing on the convention floor right under the large sign for Delaware, our home state, standing next to our state's junior senator, Chris Coons. And the arena is so well lit that I could see them. I could see my parents through the entire speech. And standing on that stage, I just thought, you both were so scared when I came out. You were so worried of rejection in every sense of the word. And I hope in this moment, I hope in this arena, that both of you know that at least for me it's going to be okay, that you don't have to worry. And really that's what was going through my mind, that I didn't want my parents to have to worry anymore. I wanted my parents to know that I was going to be okay. And you know, the history and the celebrations and the comments from other transgender people, those came afterwards. But in that moment, I thought of them and I thought of Andy.
Sarah,
I love that.
Great story. It's your family's amazing support of you that has made, an incredible difference in the life of a transgender woman. It's something that you and I both know a lot of our friends don't share. Would you talk a little bit about why it makes such a difference that your parents and your siblings and your friends and people in college embraced you, and how that helped you get on the road to activism? Because I think for so many, the biggest fear is, if I come out, will people still love me?
Right. You know, I never worried about rejection before I came out. I knew that my parents would stand by me, but I did worry that they wouldn't be able to love me in the same way that they loved their child, the child who they thought I was. And I worried that they'd be so disappointed, that they'd feel like the 21 years of raising me had gone out the window and that there was no future ahead of me. And when I came out, you know, they had a difficult time. In many ways, it felt like to them I was dying. But they did make clear to me from the start that they loved me, that they supported me, and that they'd be by my side with whatever steps I felt like I needed to take. And that's so rare, to your point. Coming out for me was the hardest thing that I had ever done up until that point, but it was still relatively easy compared to the experience of so many people across this country and around the world.
it was so, so much easier than the transgender person of color who's fearing violence merely for walking down the street as the person that they are. It was so much easier than the transgender young person who's been kicked out of their house because their parents don't just have a difficult time with them being transgender, but downright refuse to accept them, refuse to house them, refuse to give them financial support. And, you know, for me, I can't imagine what my journey would have been like had my parents and my friends not been supportive and not been by my side in the ways that they were. I might not have been able to continue to go to college. I might not have been able to afford to pursue the legislation that we were able to pass in Delaware. And certainly I wouldn't have been able to have my parents by my side through that process. And I will say there are so many politicians that say in Delaware, Sarah, you did a great job, but your parents, that was the reason why the bill passed. And so having that support has not just made a world of difference. It has made all of the difference in many ways in my life. And my goal is to try to make sure that the privileges that I've had, the privilege of being able to stay in school, the privilege of being able to keep my family, that those are no longer privileges for people in the LGBTQ community, that coming out should never mean losing your family or losing your job or being unsafe. And that's been sort of my motivation over the last 6 years from the start, was that recognition of my own privilege and the recognition of how that privilege completely transformed my own experience. And that it shouldn't be unique. That should be universal for every LGBTQ person.
Let's talk a little bit about something that I think goes back to what I said earlier about you being a role model. Not long after the convention, you got an email. And it was a picture of a little 7-year-old girl with long, red, wavy hair. She was watching CNN. And from the angle of the shot, you were on the screen. Couple weeks after that, you apparently invited them down to HRC in Washington. And a little bit out of the book. Hi, Lulu. I'm Sarah. I said kneeling in order to be eye level with the 7-year-old. What do you say we go get some juice and your mom and I can have some coffee? You guys went over to the coffee shop. Her mom said to you that she had some questions. And you, of course, were excited about that. And, you know, 7-year-old in her own way. Who's trans, and she took her little piece of paper and folded it out, and I could just imagine this going on. And she started with this one. Miss Sarah, she started, what's your favorite part about being trans? Sarah, what is your favorite part about being trans?
Well, my answer to Lulu was sort of threefold, that my favorite part about being trans is that, one, it led me to my husband. It led me to meeting Andy and having the opportunity to love him and learn from him. I told her that another part of why I love being transgender is that I think it's made me a better person, a more compassionate person, a stronger person than I was when I first came out. And then the third reason I told Lulu that I was proud to be transgender is that I get to meet young people like her, beautiful, brilliant, and brave people who are living their truth and dreaming big dreams all at the same time. Young people who, to your question, ask other transgender people, what is your favorite part about being transgender? And like I said, now I ask that question to every transgender young person I meet because I think it is such an important perspective to think about and to approach our identities with. But those are the reasons why I'm proud to be transgender, because of the community that I'm a part of, because of the people I've gotten to meet, because of the man that I was able to fall in love with, and because of the impact that it's had in my own life.
Sarah, I love what you were saying about the transgender community and allies and the need for that and the leverage of that to move forward. And I relate to it so much, being a gay man who, you know, lived through the plague and everything that happened there, which was very much a sense of allies coming together and supporting particularly gay men when we were the absolute most vulnerable from being under siege from the disease as well as the unfriendly government and everything else. My question to you, though, is that what do you see as the future for transgender people, particularly in terms of intersectionality? And I realize this may be a little premature, since, you know, the transgender community is one that I see being under siege specifically right now themselves. But, for example, with this huge issue right now of gun violence and
mm-hmm.
even the Me Too movement, what can
mm-hmm.
what do you see that the transgender community can step out and voice to say, hey, you know, yes, we're fighting for our own equality, but we're getting involved in this too, and here's our position?
Well, I think in my advocacy and in all of our advocacy around LGBTQ equality, we have to start from a place of recognizing that LGBTQ people, including transgender people, are also women and workers and people of color and immigrants and Muslims, which means that there is no, as Audre Lorde said, there's no such thing as a single issue cause because no one lives single issue lives. And unless we are not just pursuing policies around equality based on sexual orientation and gender identity, but also making sure that we're approaching issues of racial justice and economic opportunity and gender equity and immigrant rights, unless we're pursuing equality on all of those fronts, then we're going to leave far too many people within the LGBTQ community behind. And that's why as a community terrorized at Pulse, we must, as a community, fight to combat the scourge of gun violence in America. It's why, as a movement launched in response to police violence at the Stonewall Inn, we must always say that Black Lives Matter. It's why we must protect the 75,000 Dreamers that are LGBTQ living in America today that have been targeted by Donald Trump and Mike Pence. And it's why we must always recognize that when people are living at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities, that the prejudices they face are not additive. They compound one another. When transphobia meets misogyny and racism, it can have often deadly consequences. And so again, if we aren't pursuing equality from every perspective, if we aren't meeting our work on LGBTQ equality with racial justice and gender equity and so many other issues that we face, there are going to be too many people who may be able to achieve their dreams based on sexual orientation and gender identity, but will face roadblocks because of their race, because of their gender, because of their religion, because of their immigration status. And so in my work, in the work of the Human Rights Campaign, we always try to approach every issue from that perspective and recognize that our work always has to be and always will be intersectional.
So you and I have been very fortunate to work with one another to combat our opponents, for lack of a better word, to fight junk science. And of late, in the last week, it has been a new crop of opponents that are coming up. A new book by the Heritage Foundation, by Ryan T. Anderson, When Harry Became Sally, questioning the entire science behind, gender dysphoria. Bryn Tannehill, our good friend and ally, wrote a wonderful response to that in The Advocate about rapid onset gender dysphoria. And now there's a new mm-hmm. one I've been talking to you about, privately, that we are expecting to appear in The Atlantic from problematic writer Jesse Signal. And I'm wondering, what's your advice to both LGBT people and just the folks who are looking to read a book? How can they tell what's junk science and what's not? How does HRC help with that?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And last year, HRC actually launched an initiative to make sure that we were educating the public and our own community as to the junk science that's out there. And one of the first things that anyone should do when they're looking at opinions, particularly opinions that may seem to marginalize others that claim to be rooted in science, is to look as to whether that opinion or that piece of so-called research is appearing in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. So much of the anti-LGBTQ junk science that we're seeing is published in non-peer-reviewed entities, whether that's mainstream publications or whether that's online blogs, basically, that have been created to espouse these anti-LGBTQ personal prejudices. And so it's always important in everything that we do, not just when we're looking at junk science around LGBTQ issues, but also junk science around climate change, when we're looking at fake news on our newsfeed, to evaluate the source of that information. Another is to familiarize yourselves with the statements and positions of the major mainstream medical associations and organizations. the AMA, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American School Counselors Association, all of these entities, these well-respected, long-established entities, have affirmed that transgender identities are real, that transgender people are who they say they are, who we say we are, and that the only way to address gender dysphoria is to allow transgender people to transition, is allow transgender people to live their authentic lives, and to affirm them in those gender identities. Because we understand that gender isn't as was mentioned before, it's not based in DNA, it's not based in a specific body part, it's based on what's in our minds, and that transgender people are who they say they are. And so I think it's important to educate yourself, it's important to look at the mainstream medical associations, and it's important to evaluate the sources of the information that you're seeing.
And don't be confused by the American College of Pediatricians versus,
right.
You know, there's lots of like little phony organizations out there that sound legitimate, but they aren't.
Right. Right. And you know, if you are seeing positions that are attempting to dehumanize a person, think twice. Do a little bit more research. And, you know, Google is a wonderful thing, and it's out there, and it's available. And when you actually research this, you see that the overwhelming medical and scientific consensus is behind the dignity and reality of transgender identities.
So for our listeners who are wondering, here's some information. Sarah's book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, is going to go on sale March the 6th, and she's going to be out promoting it. You, by the way, pre-order the book. You'll get a nice pre-signed book plate from her. On March 6th, Sarah and the book will debut at the Strand in New York City. On the 7th, she will be in Philadelphia at the Free Library of Philadelphia. On March the 8th, she'll be in Boston at the Boston I could never pronounce that. That's a medium. March the 9th, she'll be in Atlanta. She'll be at the LGBT Institute at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. On March 12th, she'll be at my favorite bookstore, Powell's, in Portland, Oregon. Then on the 13th, she'll be up the coast in Seattle at the Seattle Public Library. Then she travels to Bellingham, Washington, and Village Books. Then it's down to San Francisco. Maybe, Rob, you can shoot up and get her to sign your copy. March 15th, she'll be in San Francisco at the Booksmith. March 16th, across the bay in Berkeley. On the 19th, back to her hometown of Wilmington, Delaware. And then on the 20th, she's back in Washington at Sarah and Mai's favorite bookstore, Politics in Prose. If you have any questions, visit prh.com/forward. Sarah McBride for more details. Sarah, do you have anything to add to that little blurb or no?
That was a great blurb. It's going to be a fun and exhausting tour. And also people can find information on the tour and how to pre-order the book at sarahmcbride.com.
Right. And I will say the invitation for me to shoot up makes me sound like an even greater Sarah McBride addict than I already am. But what I will do is we will be definitely talking about the San Francisco and Oakland events off my other radio show out in Santa Cruz, which hint, Sarah, will definitely invite you to, if you want to call into that ahead of that book signing, because we're south of that, but very excited to have you in the Bay Area. but I do want to ask you, Sarah, and I'm hoping, and I don't mean this in the flighty way that we may ask other guests, but I seriously, seriously hope that in your dreams and to-do list is a plan to run for higher office. And I realize that if that is the plan, you may not want to divulge that right now, but I'm hoping you might give us a hint if there are some aspirations there.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. And you know, I have a great job right now. I feel like this is a critical moment in the fight for LGBTQ equality. I'm able to affect change in my job with the Human Rights Campaign, and I really want to make sure that I'm part of this movement at this important time. But at the end of the day, politics is the place where every avenue of society converges, where you can affect change on a multitude of issues. And you know, maybe down the road, running for office is something that's in my future, but honestly, right now, I'm so focused on this book, and I'm so focused on the important work that I'm doing at the Human Rights Campaign, and I feel fortunate and blessed to be able to be doing that work and doing it with such great colleagues. So I've learned in my life that life has a way of intervening when you make plans, and so I've gotten out of the prediction business.
Life is what happens when you make other plans. I love that. Now, other than saying, read my book, what's your one-sentence answer when people who don't understand transgender and they want to ask you, well, what is it? I don't understand it. Help me. And they're genuinely curious. They don't understand. They want to understand it. And you only have like an elevator pitch of a time to try to explain to someone what it is you and I and other 1.4 million people are. How do you explain that to folks? I was just curious.
How do I explain trans identities to folks? Or how
How do you explain trans identity to somebody who doesn't understand it and they're just curious and they say, you're transgender, what's that?
Well, what I usually say and what I talk about in the book and sort of what I alluded to before is that we need to allow folks to understand what it feels like to be us. And the way I describe it is that having a gender identity that differs from your sex assigned at birth, not being able to express it and not having it seen by society, feels like a constant feeling of homesickness, an unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that would only go away when I could be seen and affirmed as myself. And homesickness with geography, it dissipates with time and getting used to your new surroundings, but my homesickness, it only grew with time and distance. And so I always share that experience because I think that's so important for people to enter in on. But then the final thing that I would say is that people don't have to understand exactly what it's like to be transgender. No one knows what it's like unless they walk a mile in someone else's shoes. And so what I always say is that what's most important in this national conversation on transgender rights is recognizing that transgender people are people who hurt when we're mocked, who hurt when we're discriminated against, and who just want to be treated with dignity and fairness.
On that happy note, I don't really have a question, but I'm going to read an endorsement from the book jacket that I think really fits, and then we'll probably hand it back to Rob. Tomorrow Will Be Different is a book about falling in love, being true to yourself, and creating change. Sarah's journey is as relatable as it is inspiring, a powerful, compelling story beautifully told by a fearless activist who has only just begun to make her mark on the world. Cecile Richards, President of Planned Parenthood, and I totally endorse that as my own personal view, and I'm so honored, Sarah, to count you as a friend. Rob?
Yeah. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for being on with us tonight. You have been an absolute joy. In my mind, you are an absolute hero, and I think the book is heroic. I definitely hope lots of people read it to understand not only your experience, but your landmarks, and you really outline a lot of the process. I mean, as you outline in the book how to get an equality bill through and the pitfalls and all that. What have we not asked you in the last minute that we should have?
Well, I think this has been a really incredible conversation, and Rob and Brody and Dawn, I enjoyed having the chance to answer your questions and talk with you, and all of your kind words mean a lot to me. I think you've asked pretty much every question, and you know, I think what I want people to know is that throughout this book and throughout my experience over the last 6 months, I remain as hopeful as ever that change is possible, and I want people, even in these dark moments, to understand why, no matter what comes our way, I remain hopeful, and I hope they will feel as hopeful as I do after reading this book.
Perfect. Thank you so, so much. And thank our listeners for listening. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back next week, this same time, Thursday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on Saturdays, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to that live stream on www.ksco.com. Until then, for Brody Levesque, Don Ennis, myself, and our special guests, we thank you for listening, and we can't wait to talk to you again.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!